mystery tape 80-5, side 3.
Must be a reporter or something, I don't know.
And we were talking earlier about the whether the people in charge really knew that much or wanted to know that much about the mission. What about the press at this time? Were you?
That's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, about halfway through my tour there, the word I got was that the Air Force had realized that the Army was getting an awful lot of publicity there, and they wanted to change that. They wanted to show the Air Force side of the story. And one of the ways of doing that, they brought in a new colonel as the OI, IO, whatever they called him in 7th Air Force. McGinty, as I recall, was his name, out of Washington. One of the Sharpies in the PIO business. And he was going around and visiting different combat units, flying with them and listening to them and getting what they do and how they do it. You know, and trying to, this was part of the education for not only the civilian populace and the press, but it was also for other military too. And he came down to see us, and he came back, spent a week or two there, and he was really impressed. He said, "Boy, this is it. This is the gung-ho Air Force type thing right here." You know, he saw the scarves and he saw the briefing room, and he flew a mission or two with us, and we.
You guys using the commando hats at that time?
Yeah, the whole, you know, everything. Yeah. This was real Hollywood stuff to him, I guess. And he said, "Boy, this has got to be high on the list of all these. You know, when we're going to show somebody about what's going on." And from that moment on, which was seems like about July of 70 or of 66. He would run everybody in the world over there, all kinds of reporters and human interest type stories. And I remember suddenly we were getting besieged with about once a week or two or three times a month, there'd be somebody there doing a story or, you know, talking about defoliation. And I got two scrapbooks full of different type articles. Denby Fawcett out of Hawaii was out there, and we had CBS and Dan Rather came out and bit a big spread, and Collinsworth off another network was there. And what happened on those two instances with TV is that they took the security element off of the crop destruction mission. Up till then, the only thing we publicly talked about was the herbicide defoliation of communications and fortifications and things like that. And then they had opened it up, and I don't know that it was intentional from the higher ups, but I don't know, or whether it was this guy McGinty from the OI that got it in the forefront of the press. And anyway, all of a sudden everybody was interested in this new chemical warfare type thing of, you know, crop destruction. So we had the TV guys went along with us, you know, while we went over some rice crops and so on, and that really got a lot of attention. I understand that because of that and some other similar type things, this guy McGinty was finally jerked out of there and sent someplace else. But after that, as a result of all that exposure in the press and the TV and the media, we started getting a lot of senior people, military type people that were interested in this, you know, and they'd stop by and want to fly with us and do this and that. Up to that time, I suppose the only colonel that we'd had flying with us was old Heine Aderholt. He just got a big kick out of it. He'd come and fly with us once in a while. Real commandos. When we were part of the 309th, we couldn't even get our own squadron commander or wing commander to go fly with us. And that, you know, that just further clarified in our guys' minds the distinction between the trash haulers and our guys. But we started to get, I wouldn't call them dignitaries, but I'd call them field grade officers, lieutenant colonels and colonels, and an occasional general officer that would want to come down and get a briefing on what and how we did it and so on. And obviously during that time when the crop destruction thing was hit the front pages, there was also a lot of flack going on back in Washington about the scientific community were trying to stop the defoliation effort overall, you know, because they said we were ruining the environment and not achieving the purpose of winning the hearts and minds. We were turning people against us, and it was working counter to the purposes. But I, you know, that's not for me to say. It's just you know, my perception at that time that yes, we suddenly got an awful lot of interest. Now, you know, when we started having those 10 and 12 airplanes and busy, and you take the number of hits we were getting was going up. We were really hammering it, just working out of the two bases, Da Nang and Tonsonet. And the DMZ project was big. The guys that were on the Laos project got their tours reduced, some of them. Got to leave early because of the numbers of missions they had over in Laos. I don't remember what the count was, that you could get a month off your tour for every 30 missions or something like that that you had over in Laos.
That.
Yeah. A couple of guys came home early. Charlie Yerkes came home early. I went up and pulled him out of Da Nang and said, if you can be on an airplane, you can go home today. And he made it out of Da Nang.
Oh, yeah. Don't say it twice.
And Dick Peskin, he got out a little bit early. One or two others got out a month or two early off their tours for missions over in Laos. And they later cut that out. Of course, we used to get an air medal for every 20 missions, too, as I recall, or 25, just like some of the fire guys did, and they later changed that back around, I guess, too. But, no, I think that education came as numbers increased. You got to realize that in 65, 66 was the big beginning of the big build-up there. And so I'm sure the more people you got, the more exposure you got to it and so on. A lot of people wanted to know what you're doing and how, and more questions and more interest.
Well, who was doing the targeting? Was it Vietnamese or U.S.? How did you get your targets this
time?
Well,
okay. I'm not sure that I totally can clarify that, but I'll give you my perception as best I recall it of how that was done. First off, several sources, either an Army planning group or a commander, could say he wanted to have an operation or wanted to have his base camp or something like that cleared off. Or this was a concentration of VC base camps, and they would like to maybe either force them to move, which are one of the functions that's not talked about very much, is when we squirted down something, the VC sometimes would avoid it or pick up and move on or replan. They were a great sandbox planner, so this might cause them to alter some course of action. So some Army commander or some Arvin commander might want that done, or some Arvin or Vietnamese, for whatever his particular purposes are, would go to his province chief and say that they wanted to have this done or that done. That I always had some suspicions about as to what some of their motives were, you know. But we didn't question that. Ours was a you call, we haul type thing. But at any rate, all of the targeting was submitted up through various approval elements. And once it was in the consideration stage, we would actually fly out to the province capital and meet with the province chief or his planners, and our Army Chemical Corps guys would go along with us, and everyone would agree that here's the target area boundary, and yes, I approve you going in there. That was that VNAF or Vietnamese province man's approval that was needed to do that. We would recce those areas and plan it, even if we'd been over the target, to make sure we understood what was currently there and pick out areas of crop or define points in the target area. And then it would come back and go through the American channels of approval. And at that time, we were told that Ambassador Lodge had to actually approve any of the crop destruction targets. Now, the regular defoliation type targets went up just through the province chief level, and then some other ops guy, I guess, over in 7th Air Force approved us going regular defoliation targets.
Crops was a high level.
Crops was high level. Each one of them, we were told, and I don't know this for a fact, but I was told on several that we were held up on, that Lodge did not get his approval to it, the ambassador. But that was our understanding. And once that had been approved, what we would not relinquish was the date and time. That was our prerogative. We would make up our plan and our frags and all, and about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, we'd take them over to TACC. Being right there on the base made that convenient.
Al, did your wife know?
I think so. I have a phone call.
We were talking about the targeting and who had done it. You were mentioning the routine targeting on the defoliation. Lodge had to approve it.
Yeah. Well, that procedure was generally achieved at a level that, you know, different from us. We had to sign off. Had the signed off target sheet that was approved. That was called to us by the Army Chemical Corps guys, and from there on we went into the coordination route with the province chief about the area of the target and any second thoughts on his part. And then it was after that an all Air Force planning type show, with the exception of the Army providing the logistics support on the chemical. Thanks, Pooch. Yeah. I'm no psychologist. I did a little study in college at A&M on that, but it's pretty obvious that, as I said before, that adversity, real or perceived, in an operation like that, breeds a lot of closeness. And any intelligent human being is not going to want to put himself in a dangerous situation, and especially one that he doesn't feel that he's going to get himself out of. Our guys all kind of had an attitude of invincibility that they tried to form, you know, of a view of fate, that fatalism. And, you know, you knew it was on their minds. And they joked about it, and they talked about it, and the way they approached it, and some of them, the way they relieved the tension in different ways. But quite a study in human nature with that small organization that I had, which probably was about 50 people, made a point of watching each other, you know, and you could see it. When a guy first came into country, he was really apprehensive because he didn't know what he was getting into, you know, and he'd be about that high off the ground. And after a couple of weeks, he started to swagger and get his confidence up, you know, and one of the guys, and he had his baptism of fire, and he hung in there, and then he began to share in the pride and everything else. The period of time as a guy neared the end of his tour was a very interesting phenomenon, I guess, where he began to get a little bit antsy. You know, he began to wonder whether his luck was going to hold out or whether his odds were going to still be in his favor, and you could see that. And I couldn't understand how. No, it was related to a goal. I decided that here a guy knew he was going to go home on X day, and he could see things moving along toward X day. And as he approached it within that last month, some guys took some special attention. And I couldn't understand really, after a lot of thought in this and discussing it with some of the guys, take Jack Spray. Now Jack was there when I was there some 36 months, 38 months, and he didn't suffer that. You know, he didn't, those visible signs that a guy was, not that he was getting shaky, is that he was getting so good he was going to kill himself. If 100 feet was good, well, 50 feet was better, and if 50 feet was better, well, 10 feet was great, and maybe I better get below the trees here and pop up once in a while, you know. He didn't have that, and I couldn't understand whether he was just that experienced or insensitive or what. And when they finally told him that he wasn't going to be able to stay anymore, that he had to go home, and he had that goal that had not been there. He was going to be there for the duration, you know, I guess. But at the time, then they gave him that date. And, you know, he showed a worse case of it than anybody else. Yeah, and I actually had to pull him off. I had to ground him from flying spray missions for a couple of weeks. And until he kind of got back on his feet, and he went up, and I don't know that he perceives it in this way now, but this was my thought when I did it. We put him on a special project up in 7th Air Force where he rode in the back of an 01 and did something over in Laos, or, you know, some study where he felt like he was still contributing and something to do with his time. And then he came back, and I says, okay, you know, you settle down enough, yeah. And so he flew another couple of missions and went home after a little bit of relief there. But I thought that was very interesting, a human phenomenon that, you know,
that's an interesting point. I realize this is really speculation, pure opinion. Do you think the 1 year tour was a good idea in this,
yeah,
in this kind of world?
Yeah, I have mixed emotions on that, but basically I think it was good. It got an awful lot of experience across the Air Force. And I say on this kind of deal, I'm talking Air Force wide now. Mm-hmm. Brought a lot of guys in. The problem was, is in my judgment, is that we weren't fighting a war to conclude it at the earliest possible time. We were one-upsmanship type of a thing. And I'm not trying to get into debate over principles of the war, but I don't, you know, I'm of the group that thinks if we had had linebacker two in 65 or 66, that we'd have had a much different conclusion to that thing. Whether or not it was acceptable or not, it got less acceptable the longer we stayed and the more we tried to gloss over the light at the end of the tunnel and, you know, just to give me a little more time and we'll work this out, and it didn't happen that way. We lost the war back here in the Congress and in the newspapers and the TV and the lack of overall support is my personal judgment. In a second tour that I had over there in a fighter squadron, I particularly noted that phenomenon. But there it had another factor in it. A guy would come over and he'd be off the ground, and he was surviving until he got his mid-tour leave. They threw that in. We didn't have that when I was there in 65 and 66. We didn't run a guy out of country for a week and send him to Australia or Japan or wherever. But these guys they'd be particularly hazardous right after they got there, just before their mid-tour leave, which was just a semi-going-home type of a fever. And then when they got back off of that leave, first couple of days there, then they got back all right. You know, if they were off the ground this high when they initially arrived in country, when they came back off of that mid-tour leave, they were up here, you know, because they knew what was there then.
8 foot there.
Yeah. And then just before they went home, those were critical periods. Now, with the guys that we had there, again, early 66, where we had 15 pilots and 7 airplanes to fly. Well, I would try to keep that one guy out of country. We were on ACM orders, additional crew member orders of a 315, so our guys could go down and get on an airplane as a crew member that was going to Bangkok or going to Hong Kong maybe, or Japan or Singapore, and that way, that was our little mid-tour leave. And we would move that around, you know. We'd see a guy was building up a head of steam because he'd been taking a lot of hits and he could only laugh them off so much. He was getting a little bit pent up. We'd run him out of country, you know, and let him relieve that, bring him back, and ease him back into it again, and it worked pretty good. We used a few other little things. The way I would size it in my mind, it's kind of like selling Volkswagens. You don't talk about how cramped they are. You talk about how nice it is to have that economy and the flexibility and moving around in traffic. So we got to do the same thing. So we said, well, okay, we're the most shot at guys over here. We made a big to-do over that, okay? Well, who's the most shot at of the most shot at? So we started the Master Magnet Ass Award. And contrary to something I read here today, that it was a way of pointing a finger at a guy. No, that wasn't the point at all. We weren't trying to heckle a guy and, you know, criticize him for it. We're trying to, you know, give him a point of pride there. And sure, there was a subtlety in there. Was there something he was doing wrong to get that? Maybe, but that wasn't anywhere in our consideration. The point being that we had guys that would fight to be in the lead on one target or in the tail end on another target, because that's where you were going to get all that action. You know, they wanted to be there in a month. So, that was where it was at. And we continually went up and down that about who was going to get to go here and there. I remember Jim Weaver, the guy that finally died in a B-57. Jim planned, you know, as I told you before, he planned the target that was his target. And this was that big hot thing where we were going to go down and troll for these guys. And Jim planned that whole thing out, and then I guess he was a little over-tarked the night before, you know, and let a little steam off, overslept. And when it came time to brief, Jim wasn't there. So I had to step in, and I had followed along, so I briefed the target, and we were dressed and getting ready to go, and up he comes roaring on his motorcycle, a little bit bent over. I said, Jim, I'm not going to let you take the target today. And boy, he was hostile. And I stuck to my guns, and he finally said, well, Jesus, can I at least go along and ride over the radios? And I said, yeah, you can do that. I'm not going to let you fly this thing. Well, it was just a point that a guy had a responsibility, and he hadn't held up to his on that occasion, and he knew the rules, and he didn't take precautions to adhere to them. So that worked out all right.
Was there, in the period, especially in the early part, was there any lack of targets, or was the Army, as fast as they saw what happened, asking for more?
No, I don't perceive any lack of targets. We, you know, the numbers of times that we hit a target was kind of our judgment. We would estimate how many we thought it took, and then we'd go back and look it over and say, well, we didn't do such a good job here or there. It looks like still a little green here or there, better hit it again. And we could always, you know, kind of adjust our schedule based on those. Sometimes we had periods of time, windows, if you will, of availability that caused us to do it. But there was no shortage of targets in my perception of it. None at all.
Did you get much feedback from either intelligence or the Army or the ARVA?
No.
On effectiveness?
No, and that varied with the type of target material, in the sense of the defoliant, but with the type of tree you were hitting. Well, you know, you hit a rubber tree, you're going to get about 90% improvement on vertical visibility because it's got very small branches, and whatever leaves are there just fall off if the wind hits it right. So, you know, you could see yourself the effectiveness. When you got over a triple canopy type stuff, you'd say, have I been here before? You know, it's uncertain. And you'd get various degrees of reports, varying from I didn't know you were there to Jesus was great, you know. No feedback on crops other than occasional. We did, as a matter of fact, I even asked that question a couple of times. Hey, you know, how are we doing? Give us a scorecard here. What's the intelligence feedback? And that's when we started getting some of this business about the effects on the human side of what it was doing through the intelligence side, what the VC were claiming. And we were also warned a little after that we could consider ourselves on hit list around Saigon. Like they had a number on several of the people that they shouldn't take unnecessary precautions and so on. And we got some guys that were grenaded in their quarters in Saigon one time. And the typical concern of riding around town in a truck, a pickup where they could throw something in the back, or the bread truck we had, throw something in the back of that. We had guys bail out of the bread truck one morning. They were picking guys up or taking them home, I don't remember what, and some idiot threw a Coke bottle or a can in the back of a truck, scared the hell out of these guys, and they just jumped out of it while it was going, and fortunately it didn't hurt anything. It just ran up on the curb and popped.
I had to wait to see if it was grenade to ask questions second.
But,
were most of the troops living in town? Or did you have some base quarters?
The enlisted types lived on base in the barracks, and the officers lived all in town, to my knowledge. And later on, there were a few that didn't want to live. This was just before we left the Saigon area, there were a few guys that didn't want to live off base, and they lived, I think there was one or two. But by and large, they would share villas. There were four guys living in my villa, including myself. Russ Mooney had three in his, and a couple others. There were about eight or nine of them that lived in one place, along with some other trash hauler guys up outside the base. So they lived all over town. Jack lived way downtown on the main street in Saigon.
Kind of an informal arrangement.
Yeah, and that held over. Yeah, it was up to you, to make those housing arrangements, and usually the quarters were kind of hand-me-down type things. When I got over to Vietnam, Jack Gentry, I don't know whether you know Jack or not. Well, Jack and I had known each other since 52. And we went through Hubbard together, but he went into the trash haulers at Tonsonute. And therefore, he was over there about a month to 6 weeks before I got there. So he made arrangements for our quarters and got me a room in this villa. And a couple other guys that were in his outfit. So I lived with three trash haulers in my villa. When I left, that villa reverted to some Army guys because they jacked up the price too high for everybody else. But we paid $400 or $500 for that villa and thought we had a good deal. Yeah, and we were getting a housing allowance. So, it was, we were living comfortably, really.